Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 71. We are live tonight on DLive, which is our new home, and we know why it's our new home. We're not on YouTube anymore. And we are also live on RadioAlbion.com. Now, Radio Albion is the home of the incredible Sven Longshanks. He produces some amazing nationalist material. He also restreams an awful lot of nationalist material. So if you're ever starved of great material to watch or listen, go on over and visit RadioAlbion.com and support the excellent work of Sven Longshanks. Now, if you can't watch the whole show or if you've missed any shows, you can check them out on replay, and they are on my BitChute account. My BitChute account is where you can find every single episode of Patriotic Weekly Review and my entire back catalogue of weekly videos. They are on BitChute because it is the last place where free speech exists. Please support not only my work there, but also the platform. They do deserve your support, and we have to support alternative platforms over and above ones like YouTube, which have heavily censored us. Now, obviously, if you want to contribute to this show or if you want to ask questions, you can do so. The best way to contribute or to ask questions is through Entropy. Now, if you want the Entropy link, it is on my Telegram, it is on my Twitter, and I am just posting it in the live chat now. So if you want to make financial contributions, super chats, please do so through Entropy. Now, all super chats are read out live on the show, and all questions are asked to the panel or to the relevant member of the panel. You can also donate to me via Bitcoin, and my Bitcoin address is on my BitChute, or you can write to me to get it. You can also write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com if you want to donate via bank transfer or to contribute in any other way or need to get in touch with me about anything. So that's the way to contribute and the way to get in touch. Now, a couple of small pieces of information before I pass it to Jason, then we introduce our very special guest for tonight. Number one, I am debating a guy who is part of the Black Advocacy Movement. I am debating him most likely next Friday at something like 9 p.m. UK time. That's 4 p.m. Eastern time. And Jason will be hosting that most likely on his DLive so we can have an honest conversation. That's something to look forward to. Please put it in your diary, and I will be making sure that everyone gets the links to that and that is fully promoted in advance. Now, the other little announcement I have is after this show, the White Art Collective are live on, I believe, YouTube and DLive. And later in the show, I am going to be showing something from the White Art Collective. It's a little trailer for their forthcoming Halloween video competition, which you can all take part in. I really like those guys. They were on the show a few weeks back. It was an excellent show. It's available on BitChute, and they are a group that we should all support. Their work is absolutely excellent, and supporting artists who are white positive and support our cause is something we should all do. Now, before we go over to the amazing Arthur Kemp, Jason, what have you been up to this week, my friend, and who's on tap?
All things amazing. We had a trip, and there were a couple of meetings, IRLs that we attended. Great things happening there. Some interesting things that we'll be able to see in the coming weeks about that are relevant to or connected to the work that I was doing over the past couple of days. Also, of course, working on Crucible, which is almost finished now. And a big thank you to everybody who has been helping with that. And that should be available in the next week or so. Very excited about that, as you might imagine. And TAP is going to be this Friday, the after party this Friday over on my different platforms and channels. It's going to be at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with Eke Lux. And a member of our community that I'd like to spotlight today is Final Blossom. And I'll be sharing, he's on YouTube, and I will be sharing his link over the course of the show in the live stream. It is a great pleasure to be here with Arthur Kemp, and a great author, and looking forward to everything that he has to say, and a pleasure to be with you, Mark, and everybody that is with us in the live chat and in replay. So I pass it back so we can get this underway.
Well, this is a show I have personally been looking forward to for a very, very long time. I've known Arthur Kemp since, I would say, the mid part of the 2000s. Mm. He was a major player in the British National Party and one of the two men who were widely regarded as the best nationalist speakers that the party had. That was Arthur Kemp, and of course the other we've spoken of before was Jonathan Bowden. Arthur and Jonathan were seen as the best orators in the party. And I always remember when Arthur was booked for a branch meeting, there would always be record numbers of attendees. He used to always raise the roof. But not only is Arthur a phenomenal orator and an excellent nationalist voice, but he is also a superb author. And his books are some of the best that you can buy. Most notably, his book, March of the Titans, A History of the White Race, is possibly the best education you can receive in one single book. I have the hardback version. It's not actually in the house I live now. It's back with my parents because they borrowed it from me to read the whole thing. It's absolutely superb. And if you haven't got that absolute masterpiece, yeah, there will be a link in the description on the BitChute replay for how you can purchase this, and to Arthur's excellent website, Astara Publications. Now, without further ado, I am so looking forward to this. Here is Arthur Kemp. Please introduce yourself, my friend. Tell everyone a bit about your work, a bit about who you are, and obviously explain about Astara Publications. And if you want to tell us a little bit about March of the Titans, that would be absolutely phenomenal.
Hi, Mark. Great to see you again. Thanks so much for having me on the show. No white guilt. Great to meet you at last. Thanks for that fantastic introduction. Completely overrated and completely undeserved, but thank you anyway. Yeah, I started writing that book, gee, when I was at university back in 1981 or 82, and it took me about 20 years to finish the first manuscript. Took a lot of travel, a lot of work, a lot of research. And its final form was very different to how it was meant to be. It was meant to be just like a chronological history. But very early on, I ran into the biggest problem anyone studying global history finds, who approaches it from a racial point of view, in that you end up with a problem of why do some civilizations only last a very short time and others last forever? Why do the Japanese Japanese civilizations still in existence after 5,000 years? Why did the Chinese still be in existence after 5,000 years? Why did Rome collapse after 800 or 1,000 years? Why did white South Africa collapse after less than 200 years? And when you confronted with these questions and you start looking around for the traditional explanations, you find that the establishment historian explanations simply don't add up. And that was where I think I hit upon the basic truth that a civilization only lasts as long as the people who made that civilization last. If the people who made a civilization disappear, then the civilization vanishes with them. And that's a really basic and simple principle which could be proved over and over again. And that's the core message of it. And from there, it just took off. As to my own work, well, you know what I did with the BNP. That's all now old history. Before that, I was in South Africa doing things. And nowadays, I concentrate on writing and publishing. I'm trying to build up what I hope to be the most comprehensive Eurocentric resource center available today, covering topics from ancient history through to modern politics. That's basically what I'm doing.
Well, the links to your websites, marchofthetitans.com and astarapublications.com, are now in the live chat, and both of those links will be found in the description of the show on replay on BitChute. And if anyone has any trouble finding them, they can always email me. And I cannot recommend March of the Titans highly enough. It is an absolutely superb book. In fact, I think calling it just a book is sort of underplaying the level of information in that particular piece. When people talk about books, I always think of a relatively small book you'd put on the bookshelf and you'd read on the train. But this is more of sort of an encyclopedia. And I've got the original hardback version. Absolutely fantastic. I remember actually buying that from you in person at a advisory council meeting took place at that horrible old mill building in Leeds where we used to meet.
Goodness, that was a slum.
The good old days. Now, something I didn't say when I started the show, if anyone wants to contribute to the show or has questions for myself, Arthur, or No White Guilt, please use Entropy. You don't simply have to ask paid questions. You can also ask unpaid questions, and the best unpaid questions are voted up, and the best unpaid questions every week from the audience get asked to the panel. So, Arthur, since the British National Party collapsed and since you and I sadly had to part ways and disappear in different directions to do our own thing, Ostara Publications has grown and grown and grown. And I believe you have a new book just about to be released. Would you like to tell the audience a little bit about that?
The book has been released. It's called The War Against Whites, The Racial Psychological Reasons Behind the Anti-White Hatred Sweeping the West. It was a book that the outline of which I've been preparing for a little while, but it was given added impetus by the events starting maybe with George Floyd and then the massive riots and destruction which followed. Basically, the theme of the book is to understand why and to propose a solution, to understand why the current unrest in the West is occurring. Because the false narrative being portrayed by the controlled media, who are unquestionably the absolute enemy of anyone who wishes to preserve their identity. The false narrative being portrayed by the control media is that these are riots and demands and a campaign for equality, but it's not a campaign for equality because there is equality. It is a campaign for the extermination of the white race. It is a campaign which is based on unbridled hatred, distortions, lies, and disinformation designed specifically not to bring about racial equality, but to bring about the final destruction of white Western civilization. And it's very important that people understand this, that this is not a thing asking for, please, white racist policemen, stop shooting innocent black people. That's nonsense. That narrative in itself is nonsense. But this is not about demands for racial equality. This is not about demands for an end to non-white poverty. This is a demand to destroy whatever whites have built up. So the book deals with, first of all, the first chapter is the George Floyd incident, which I published the first chapter for free on the internet. You can find it on my blog at arthurkemp.com. The first chapter is there for free, and you'll get a very good idea of how the book is structured from there, because I go into all of the actual legal and medical and physical evidence in the George Floyd incident, which shows that George Floyd died actually of a drug overdose, of a cardiac arrest caused by a drug overdose. And the knee hold arrest had nothing to do with his death at all. I'm happy to see that Derek Chauvin, the policeman who's been charged with his murder, is using this very defense in an application to have the charges struck down against him, which will probably be heard within the next month or two. So it'll be very interesting. I did say in the chapter, though, that in the current hysteria of anti-white hatred, which has been generated by the mass media and the mob in the streets, people will be very lucky to get a fair court hearing in America or anywhere in the world today. So that would be counting against him. The rest of the book deals with why this is all happening. It answers very clearly the reasons, for example, why blacks claim that they are being gunned down by white racist policemen. In actual fact, all the statistics show they are not. There are, in fact, more whites in real numbers and pro rata to the arrest rate for violent crimes. More whites get killed than blacks by police in America. That is by the by. The only reason why there appears to be more, because more blacks commit more crime, therefore have greater number of interactions with the police. And every time there's a violent interaction between the police and non-whites in America, it's normally linked to some violent criminal incident. George Floyd was high on drugs. He was trying to pass a fake $20 bill. He already served 10 years in prison for a number of violent crimes. So the police had every reason to be wary of him. Then we move on to the issue of why, because then the establishment narrative is that, oh, blacks commit more crime because they suffer systemic racism and poverty. So I dealt with that. I studied the issues of poverty in America, and I show through official government statistics that pro rata and in real terms, there are more whites in poverty in America than there are blacks or Hispanics. But yet, even though the poverty rates are the same, the criminality rates are dramatically distorted. In other words, poor whites do not commit crime to the same level that poor blacks do. Having dealt with that, I then move on to the only other reason in that behavior, and behavior is inherited. Everyone knows that stupid people have stupid children, clever people have clever children, bad-tempered people can have bad-tempered children, nice people can have nice children. Everyone knows that behavioral characteristics are inherited, and all of these things combine so that you can show that even character, temperament, and behavior, and IQ, which is a major determinant factor, is all inherited. And all the statistics show that low IQ people commit more crime than high IQ people. Low IQ whites commit more crime than high IQ whites. So therefore, if you have a racial group that has an average lower IQ, ipso facto, there are going to be a large number of people in that racial group who are going to be more criminally inclined. Then the very next thing I dealt in with is the so-called aggression gene. You can look it up at some stage. You can find information about that on the internet. And also schizophrenia, in that blacks in America have a schizophrenia rate 200 to 300 times higher than whites. And although not all criminals are schizophrenics, schizophrenia is one of the common characteristics among violent criminals. When you combine all of this, you can clearly see that the higher criminality rate, therefore the higher interaction with the police rate, is not the result of so-called systemic racism. It's not the result of discrimination or whites in some weird conspiracy against non-whites. It's because of innate biology and behavior. The book then goes on to discuss other aspects of racial psychology, the one chapter, maybe my favorite chapter, is called Why Do Blacks Straighten Their Hair? And it's an interesting insight into the psychology of racial transmutation. They always accuse whites of cultural appropriation, but almost every black female that I've ever seen in the West and large, even in Africa, they all have put dangerous chemicals in their hair to make their hair straight. They all wear wigs. They all wear long, flowing, dark hair. All this hair comes from India, by the way, because it's the Indians sell their long, straight hair to Africa and to Africans all around the world. Now, the question is this. What would you say if tomorrow morning you woke up and every single white female, bar maybe 2 or 3%, every single white female that you saw was suddenly wearing dreadlock wigs and was trying to darken their skin with skin darkener? You would think, hey, what's going on? The establishment would get their psychiatrists and their psychologists out, and they'd be trying, why are white people trying to appropriate black culture? Why are white people trying to look like blacks? And they'd have debates on it. They'd have racist discussions. Oh, they're just being racist again. They're trying to take away black identity. However, blacks are trying to look like whites all over the world, and no one says anything because they're too scared to do it. And there's a very interesting underlying subconscious racial psychology of envy at work here. And all of this is combines together to show that what in fact is driving the movement today is not a drive to equality, but rather a drive, drive to anti-white hatred. It's a rebellion against the very being of whiteness. And if you want further proof of it, you just have to look at the pulling down the statues issues, where they would pull down statues of any white person, even white people who were fought slavery, gave their lives to fight slavery. The Hegg statue in Minneapolis, they pulled down the Minnesota state statue, which is a mythological figure. The statue is called Forward. It's the state symbol. It's what it does. It's a Greek style statue of a white woman holding up a torch. And they pulled that down, not because it symbolizes racism, but because it symbolizes whiteness. Having done all of that, assembled all of that, I then look at what are the only possible solutions to this. And the only possible solution to this is physical geographical separation. Because as long as the races are forced into one territory where they must compete in a first world society, on an uneven basis, on an inherently uneven basis, you're going to get conflict. Because how can you force a race that has an average IQ, for example, of 84, which is the average black IQ in America, how can you expect them to compete equally with a race that has an average IQ of 102, which is the average white IQ in America? There's just no ways they're going to compete equally without massive forced affirmative action, without massive minority set-asides, without massive promotion of everything that they have. And yet, even then, despite all of this affirmative action and pushing, the parity always fails. And this is the cause of racial conflict, the inability to achieve parity when it's promised to them. Blacks in America are told, you can do anything you want to do. You can be doctors, lawyers, NASA, rocket scientists, anything you want to be. And they map it all out and they go to college and they go and everything. And yet still the gaps in education, income, crime levels, poverty levels, the inequality remains. The promised parity is never there and can never be achieved until whites are exterminated. Now, the only way to solve this, the only way to fix this is for physical geographical separation. And it serves everybody's interests. And the example that I used in the book, it's a very good example, and I'm quite glad that I dug it out. It's the University of Liberia. Now, as you know, Liberia was a state founded in the early 1800s by members of the Colonization Society in America who wanted to send freed blacks back to Africa to get rid of slavery and give free blacks a new country in Africa to go to. Now, the University of Liberia just turned into a regular third world joke where you would have 23,000 students writing the entrance exams and they'd all pass until one day, about 3 years ago, they appointed a new black head of admissions. And this black guy said, whoa, there's something wrong here. You can't have 23,000 students writing admissions exams and all of them pass. So he investigated it and he found that the students were buying the exam papers from the lecturers, the admissions papers. So he cracked down on it. Bang! He closed them all down. He said, nope, no one's selling it. He took all the papers and he held them until the exam day, and then he personally gave them out. And you know what happened that year? And you can look all this up. That year, zero, null, nothing. No students passed the admissions exam. Absolutely no one. Because they were all expecting to get the paper beforehand. So there was the usual hubbub, boo-hoo-hoo, what's going on. But here's the critical thing. Here's the critical thing. No one blamed white systemic racism because there aren't enough whites in Liberia to blame. Now, can you imagine this happening at a college in America, where one day an honest academic forces a high quality, a high standard of academia upon all the students, and all of a sudden all the black students fail? There'd be screams. There'd be a judicial inquiries into racism, into systemic racism. What are the whites doing to the black people again? Blah, blah, blah. There will be hysteria. But in Liberia, there was nothing. Nothing at all, because there aren't any whites to blame. What they did is the next year, they did it again, and a tiny number passed. Now, the very latest one, last year, there were only 2,000, there were only 2,000 applications. Only 2,000 blacks wrote the exam, and about 1,200 passed. And those 1,200 blacks in Liberia who are now studying at the University of Liberia, everyone knows that they are academically qualified, that they passed the exams, and they're going to be real doctors and real lawyers and real engineers. So it's in their interests as well, because as long as they've got the excuse of blaming whitey for everything, they blame whites for everything. I've got examples in my book of a morbidly obese black woman appearing on the Oprah show, blaming white people because black women are fat. You know, the only reason why someone's fat is because they eat too much and they don't exercise. However, if you watch the Oprah show, these are morbidly obese black women. Jeez, they can hardly fit on the chairs. They like waddling on. Well, it's white racism causing us to be fat. The one woman even said Donald Trump is causing her to be fat. It's absolutely unbelievable. But anyway, the point is that the only way to stop this racial contest, this racial, I don't want to use a hatred, because it's not even, there's no hatred, but it's this racial division, this racial conflict is the word I'm looking for. The only way to stop this racial conflict is to physically, geographically separate. Once we are physically, geographically separated, then each race, each people will achieve its very best in its own environment. And I suppose that's the book in a nutshell. It's a very exciting book. It's selling very well. You can get it on Amazon while Amazon still stocks it, or you can get it on my website.
Well, Arthur, earlier on, you made a slight error. You said I was too kind to you when I introduced you. I think everyone now understands that I maybe was not generous enough. Mm-hmm. I think everyone in the audience now understands exactly why Arthur was regarded so highly in the British National Party and why he used to pack out meetings up and down the country. That was one of the best segments we have ever, ever had on this show. So thank you. And that was just you describing the book. And I think everyone should go out there, buy a copy of that book, and please do support Arthur's work. That was absolutely superb. Now, we spoke slightly then about racial hatred towards white people from blacks. And bearing that in mind, I would like to play this short clip. It's only 45 seconds long, but it is doing the rounds at the moment on it's doing around everywhere, but I hope you can hear this. I've got this set to maximum volume, so we'll see what happens. It's only 45 seconds long. The text is on the screen as well, but we can discuss this afterwards. It was played on the BBC, and the BBC acknowledged this. So here goes.
They're so real today. Like, the myth that we have about black power, like black power Wakanda, it's still a world where Africa was never colonized, was never pillaged for its resources. Mm-hmm. Like, white power is Trump Tower. Like, these things are put against each other, but when we say we want to kill white, we don't really mean we want to kill white. We do, but when we say we want to kill white, it's like a capitalist, not today.
Yeah, it's a show.
But when people react to people saying that, but white privilege, whiteness is a capitalist structure. It benefits itself. Yeah. It hurts white people. It hurts non-black people. It hurts black people. But still, this kind of fear of a black alternative, and it's these sort of rhetorics battled against each other. These extreme capitalist rhetorics of supremacy.
Well, there you have it on the BBC. And I'll just repeat that. She says, when we say we want to kill whitey, we don't mean we really want to kill whitey. And then she says, we do, at which point people laugh. And then she says, but when we say we want to kill whitey, it's like, yeah, but not today. Now, that was on the BBC the other day. That is the kind of bile that the BBC is putting forth. But it also shows something which I think really points to the fact we're at a great turning point in society, in civilization. Here is a black woman on national TV on a panel with whites, and she is literally saying that they do want to kill white people. Maybe not now, maybe not today. I think one of the men says not on this show or not after, not directly after this show, but really admitting that they do want to kill whitey, that they use the phrase kill whitey. And this is acceptable. And there's no pushback against this. Now, just imagine for a second that on this panel tonight, and we've got about 1,700 people watching, which is not bad for DLive, but it's nothing compared to the kind of audience the BBC enjoys on one of their primetime shows. But if anybody on this panel tonight stated that they wanted to kill people of another ethnic group, my door would be flying off the hinges at about 5 a.m. And I would be sat outside my house with my legs crossed, my hands tied behind my back, with a couple of officers from SO19 with Heckler and Cox about 1 to 2 inches from my temple. This is where we are. We're at a point where it is now absolutely above board and seen as completely normal. And this is a chat. I mean, you saw, I think the ugly fat guy with the ginger beard is Frankie Boyle. And he sat there sort of nursing his beard, considering the point. Can you imagine sitting there nursing your beard and considering the point that you should be killed for the color of your skin? No one else would tolerate that. And at one point, when we used to discuss things like this in the BNP, and I think for me and Arthur, there's probably quite a little bit of relief discussing this now. Because when I first met you, talking about these kind of things and campaigning on these issues, it was still quite a taboo then. And to actually come out and talk about issues of ethnicity, I remember when you came into the party and you were selling March of the Titans, there were people on the more civic nationalist side of the party that didn't like the book, that didn't embrace it enthusiastically, like many of the racial nationalists in the party did, because they didn't believe that it would go down this line. They could never see. They understood that our culture was being lost. They wanted to stand for traditionalism. They didn't like mass immigration. But they couldn't see that this was more than something that was cultural. They were the sort of people who wanted to put, it's more about space than race on leaflets, whereas you and I have always been acutely aware that although space is very important, this is absolutely about race. So what's your feeling towards this comedy that was shown on the BBC?
It's absolutely typical, and I think it shows very clearly. I've got another section in this War Against White's book that I didn't mention just for sake of brevity, but I'll mention it now, seeing as you've opened the door, is the chapter's called Advantage Non-Whites, How the System Discriminates Against White People. And this is merely yet another example of it. The fact that the BBC can carry a piece like that and no one says boo or bah, look at it this way. Paul Golding, who is another former BNP guy who was running Britain First, he might still be running Britain First for all I know. Yes, he is. He was arrested. He and the deputy were arrested for having a quasi-uniform, sort of flat caps and a jacket with an emblem on it. They were arrested under the 1938 Public Order Act for having a uniformed troop. Well, I saw on TV just a few weeks ago, Black Lives Matter people in London parading, drilling in full uniform. Dozens of them. Do you think they'll be arrested under the Public Order Act of 1938 for wearing a political uniform? Not a chance. And this is, it goes over and over and over again. The reality is the Black Lives Matter people and the Black Lives ideologues, the anti-white ideologues, maintain that in fact blacks are discriminated against, that non-whites are discriminated against, whereas in reality it is whites who are discriminated against. It is whites who are not allowed to organize racially. In America, you've got the Black Congressional Caucus. You've got the Hispanic Congressional Caucus. You've got the Republican Jewish Committee. You've got the Democratic National Jewish Committee. God help you if you have a white Congressional Caucus. God help you if you've got a white Republican Caucus. God help you if you do anything white. You can have Black Entertainment Television. You can have Ebony Magazine. You can have a Black Miss America. You can have Hispanic Miss America. But God help you if you have a white entertainment television. Well, God help you if you do anything like that. The state officially recognizes Black History Month, Hispanic History Month. There's even now a Jewish American Heritage Month. But no, White History Month is the ultimate in racism and extremism. That's what you're dealing with. You're not dealing with an establishment or a media which is in any way reasonable, which is in any way interested in ordinary debate, which is anyway interested in equality. They are not interested in equality. They are interested only in seeing the white race exterminated. And when you finally understand that the racial imperative is driving these people, will you have a clearer understanding of what to do and how to process forward?
Thank you very much, Arthur. Again, another excellent example of your speaking skills. Jason, would you like to comment on the Kill Whitey debacle that we just saw, the message that was broadcast on the BBC?
Well, gosh, there's so much that could be said about that, isn't there? I mean, everything that was just said, we should talk about the hypocrisy, talk about what would happen to us. I know without any question whatsoever that if we were to say something like that, I probably wouldn't have to wait until morning. I'm sure the Department of Homeland Security or FBI or somebody would show up right away, you know, within hours of that, such a thing being said. It is a product of the sort of tawdry times of anti-white ideology and their anti-white morality, that they are able with this anti-white morality to satirize the murder of white people. And it's just a chuckle. It's just something we are. Yes, of course, you're going to be killing us off. And meanwhile, in the midst of this sort of speech, they are taking down the statues as effigies to the white race, cutting their heads off, so decapitating statues, drowning statues, putting nooses around statues and pulling them up on in the trees and on light posts, dragging statues along the pavement with the ropes tied around them, the kind of thing that we saw done in Mogadishu and the like, where they took white pilots and tied their corpses up in their bodies, I guess they were still alive, and dragged them until they were dead, until all the flesh was ripped off their bodies. This is what's happening in the United States and elsewhere around the West. There is no finitude to the evil and the desire of the anti-whites to white erase us from the civilizations that we created. And Arthur's absolutely right in everything that he just was talking about since actually the beginning of the show, that it's a question of the folks who are the founding stock of these places. And we, of course, say that we're the founding stock and that these places exist inside of us. That's why they exist in the world around us. It's places like South Africa, places like the United States, places like the United Kingdom. The moment we cease to be, those places cease to be, proving what we have said all along, that this is a biospiritual creation that is a projection of who and what we are internally onto the world around us, onto the environment around us. So we're going to continue to see the vitriolic type of speech from the anti-whites. It'll be everything from the dressed in the uniforms that they are permitted to wear because we live under this anti-white morality and this anti-white narrative, the kind of thing, again, when it comes to the speech, when it comes to the uniforms, when it comes to whatever it might be, wearing hoods or whatever it might be, they're allowed to do. White people are not allowed to do. And it is all about, therefore, hurting the white race, revealing that there isn't a hypocrisy relative to these activities, because in both cases, the anti-whites get to harm the white race. I will say this, though. I don't think that non-white people and white people, that there isn't a cosmic yardstick, and there isn't a what's best for one people is the same thing that's best for all people. people. So non-white people, I mean, it might be in one of these African nations, they might struggle to be or to achieve what we consider to be a yardstick in our Western civilization, what we create. That's not necessarily what it's going to be best for them. And we shouldn't be measured by what is best for them and what their yardstick might be. This idea that, and it's part of what undermines our discussions, this idea that there's some sort of cosmic yardstick and that our, what we create, which is Western civilization, is what is natural for some other group of people. It just, we have to accept that what's natural for us is not natural for Asian people. It's not natural for Black people. It's not natural for all of these other groups of people. They are out of water in our environments. We are out of water in their environments. And if this reality gets accepted, it'll be far harder for the anti-whites to take their arguments to us, to manipulate us with their pretexts, which they've been able to do for so long and has gotten us to this point today where we can have our statues taken down as effigies. We can, in fact, just right now, I received a text less than 15 minutes ago that the Confederate, and I'm a very proud Southerner, and I'm very upset about this, a Confederate monument, another one, just down the road from me, is getting ready to be taken down. So this is white erasure of our people from our civilization. It begins with the cloth. It begins with the stone. It begins with the halls of records. And eventually it finds its way to the flesh of our people. And you know what? They came as close as you could possibly come. Of course, they actually shot and they're murdering white people for being white. That's what's taking place all over the West, particularly in the United States right now. But of course, the regime's media is not going to say it's because they're white, even though the Patriot Prayer guy, he's being targeted because he's a white guy and he's heretical to the anti-white narrative. So he was murdered. But the anti-whites actually decapitated a pig and then burnt its head on a Stars and Stripes flag out on the West Coast of what is becoming this absolutely wretched anti-white country, the United States of America, that we are this close to them doing that to human beings. That is how sick this has become. And this question about whether or not, Arthur also mentioned this a little earlier, I'll just say this, police officers who were charged with this character Floyd's death, even though he had enough fentanyl in him to kill a horse. If this happens, if they get justice, and again, this is a question we talk about, this nodal tipping point when it comes to positions of power. So many are controlled now by, so many of these nodes of power, elected, appointed, bureaucracies, etc., are controlled by anti-whites, that there may not be any justice for these people. But if somehow reasonable people look at this data and they say, well, even though we're not white positive, the right thing to do, the reasonable thing to do is to allow these guys to walk, because clearly they weren't responsible. Maybe this officer could get some sort of punishment within his department for taking a tactic that they used to restrain somebody a little bit too long. I don't know. I don't know the training. But nevertheless, maybe reasonable people, if they come to this conclusion that it's not murder or that it wasn't premeditated or that they didn't have any hand in actually killing this guy, that he died of something else, that he died of the fentanyl, rest assured there are going to be more white people murdered on the streets. There are going to be more white little boys what was his name, Hennant, shot in the head by anti-white monsters, these anti-white bastards, and they're going to be continued to get given carte blanche because of it. And this, again, will be, as we have said many times before, and I'll pass it right back so we can get back to Arthur and the very sage things that he's sharing with us. This will continue to be the justifications, because there is no escape from the justifications in the anti-white narrative to inflict injury on our people. Never in any crime committed by an anti-white on a white person, particularly a non-white anti-white person, is there ever any magnanimity? Do they ever say, I'm going to blow this little child's head off. He did something I didn't like. I'm going to blow his head off, and I'm going to overlook what I have been taught over the totality of my life and the jealousy I feel in my body, the envy I feel in my body. I'm going to overlook all of that to do this to this little child. I'm going to overlook all of that does a criminal say? I'm going to be so magnanimous. I'm going to overlook all of this. And when I rape a white woman, when I gang rape them, when I decide to murder a white person who is heretical to the anti-white narrative, never do they say that. This will never end until we recapture our destiny. These are the things that we see at the end of a civilization, ladies and gentlemen, when the builders of that civilization have let go of the reins and others control their destiny. That's why we're on this path, and it will not change until we take it back. So I'll pass it back to you all.
Well, thank you. Now, some people accuse this show of being a bad news show a lot of the time. We discuss horrible things that are happening, and unfortunately, things get a bit heavy. And tonight, we have been talking about the collapse of civilization. As such, we haven't talked about COVID, which is probably a good thing. I haven't dragged Arthur into that mire. So I think I'll be changing the graphic for this show to reflect the things we've discussed. And maybe we won't even talk about COVID, which probably will be quite refreshing for a lot of people. But I do have some good news for once. And I'm going to read this from the New York Post. And if the people in the chat think this is good news, let's get some ones in the chat. Ones in the chat if this is good news. Nearly two-thirds of young Americans do not know that 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust, study found. A new survey of Americans between the ages of 18 and 39 found that 23% of respondents said they believed the Holocaust was a myth or had been exaggerated, or they weren't sure. Now, that's pretty impressive, isn't it? That's nearly one in four Americans between the ages of 18 and 39 who actually say the numbers don't add up, who are actually saying this is a pretty big lie that we're being told, or at least a huge exaggeration. Now, I, for a long time, have felt that there have been several things that have really boxed us in. Firstly, especially in the UK, we get these sort of muddled messages of whether we should be truthful about historical occurrences. We also get the issue of how to approach being called racist. And then there's always this huge sort of cloud hanging over us that we either, and we saw this before, we've seen nationalist leaders fall at this hurdle before, that when they get asked about the Holocaust, they immediately get down on their hands and knees and start groveling. And nobody seems to be able to be big enough in a TV interview to say, look, the issue here is not that Jews suffered or didn't suffer, is that this particular historical occurrence has been wildly over-documented to the point that it is now forced down our throat to create white guilt and self-loathing among European populations. And what's more, at a time when we are told to investigate every facet of history, this one particular part of the historical narrative is completely off limits for any investigation whatsoever, to the point where you can actually be prosecuted for talking about it. Well, if the truth doesn't fear investigation, what have these peddlers of the Holocaust narrative got to fear about a little bit of a prodding and a few investigations? Well, I believe they have to fear quite a lot, because I believe, and I released videos on this, one called The Holocaust, an Instrument of White Guilt. I believe the Holocaust industry has been built up to a point where it churns out hundreds of thousands of hours of material a year. There are books printed, children are indoctrinated with it. And for some people, it seems like one of those mountains which cannot be overcome. It seems like one of those hurdles which is just too big and too strong for us to ever get past. And because of that, nationalism will always be confined to the sort of back streets of politics. But here we have nearly a quarter of young Americans aged between 18 and 39 saying that they think this has been exaggerated, that they don't think it happened as they're being told. Is this a reason for people to celebrate? Is this a reason for people to say there is actually some hope?
Mark, I don't want to be the proverbial wet blanket here, but can you just read to me exactly what the New York Times article said? Did they say that they believe it had been exaggerated, or did they say that they didn't have enough knowledge about it, or they didn't know enough about it, or they...
They believed it to either be a myth or had been exaggerated.
Actually, in those words.
A myth or exaggerated.
That's really interesting. The first thing I'll say is that there's a very strong, potentially affecting factor in that in the year 2020, this year, majority of under 18s in America are now non-white. So the age demographic spread in America is such that a very large number, if not the not at the moment the majority of under 39s, but at this stage a very large number of the under 39s, of the under 30 population, are going to be non-white. So if there's an ignorance about the Holocaust or a dismissal of the Holocaust, it's very likely to be skewed by that racial factor. A lot of the well-educated blacks in America will, of course, know everything about it, but there's a huge number of blacks who live in ghettos with minimal education, with minimal knowledge about almost anything. There was that famous case during Ronald Reagan's time where they arrested a black drug dealer selling drugs two streets behind the White House, and they brought him to a press conference in the White House, and they said to him, the press was there, and they said to him, "What are you doing selling drugs two blocks away from the White House?" And this black drug dealer says, "What's the White House?" So there's a genuine issue. There's a genuine issue with the racial demographic. So that is going to skew the statistics, what you're talking about. So I don't want to be wet blanket, but I'm just putting it out there that all of these polls, all of these opinions, all of these statistics about health, about obesity, about all of these things that are coming out of the West and America in particular, they always ignore the racial element to it. For example, the COVID deaths. They say America's got one of the highest COVID death rates. We can talk about COVID. But if you look at the CDC statistics, you'll see that 54 or 55% of all the COVID deaths in America have been amongst non-whites, even though there are still theoretically a minority of those being of the population. So that's the first thing. I put a precursor on it. But you've raised a number of very good points with it as well. The first one I'd like to address is the concern about being called a racist. I think that's a big thing that I hear time and time again. That, oh, if you stand up and say white people shouldn't be exterminated, they're going to call you a racist. Well, they're going to call you a racist or a Nazi or a fascist or whatever. They're going to call you that anyway. And if you're looking for proof of that, then just look what they write about Donald Trump, or what they broadcast about Donald. Donald Trump is the most ridiculous character to have emerged in the modern American political scene. He is hysterical. I like him merely for his amusement factor, for his ability to drive the left mad for no good reason, for no good reason at all. He just drives them mad by a sheer presence, by the fact that he beat Hillary Clinton. It's just enough to make them hate him, and the vitriol, never-ending, the torrent of abuse that pours out over Donald Trump's head is quite often deserved, because he jumps around from position to position. He says idiotic things, but the astonishing stuff that gets thrown at him for no reason at all, apart from the fact that he's not a raving lefty, shows that there is no compromise. There's no way that you can say anything real, or anything nationalist, or anything pro-white, without the media and the establishment reaching back and calling you all sorts of names. So my advice, for what it's worth, my advice is to simply ignore all of that. say what you have to say. And if someone comes to you and says, oh, but you know, they're going to call you a Nazi, then you say, well, look, they can call me whatever. Are you going to judge me by what I say? Or are you going to judge me by what my opponents, who don't ever argue the facts, but what by what they call me? And lay it out like that. And if there are small-minded, narrow, unintelligent, shallow people who are going to swallow the controlled media's line, they lost anyway, and you're never going to reach them because that's the way they are. That's the way they're programmed. So rather concentrate on getting your message out and ignore all the lies and slander. The other important issue you raise is the Holocaust is definitely, whether it happened or whether it didn't, and you always have to be careful when any public broadcast, as you quite correctly say, because you can get prosecuted in Europe and get sent to jail for saying the wrong thing about the Holocaust, which is an interesting situation in itself, because as the Farmer's Almanac said in America many years ago, the truth can run around naked, but lies need to be covered up. So your problem is, if I was running a political party that was attempting to go for political power, I would evaluate whether my chances of taking political power are dependent upon whether the Holocaust happened or not, or whether saying the Holocaust happened or not. So that would be my approach. Decide what your aim is. If your aim is to achieve political power and to save white Western civilization, then you must adopt a policy and public policy position which reflects that as your main driving point. If you want to refight the Second World War and say that the Holocaust didn't happen, then you must go ahead and do that somewhere else, but don't try and make it a major platform of saving white Western civilization. The best way to deal with it is to say the Second World War was a terrible event. Many millions of people died. We're not interested in what happened in Europe 70 or 80 years ago. That can be sorted out by the academics and the historians at a later stage when we're not facing a crisis of extermination, and make a promise that it will be sorted out one way or the other, because we are never afraid of the truth. We're never afraid of the truth. The truth is never harmful. No matter what it is, it can be sorted out later. Right now, we are aiming for a political solution to stop the destruction of white Western civilization. And this is our platform. And I would just push ahead with that, Mark, because no matter, as I said before, no matter what you say, they're going to throw the epithets at you. No matter what you say, they're going to throw the smear words at you. So the best is not to spend your time trying to defend it and trying to block what they're saying. Say what you say. And if someone says, oh, but you're a Nazi, I say, well, who said that? Yeah, exactly. Some Jewish extremist who supports Israel, which has got citizenship laws based on the Nuremberg laws and builds a wall to keep all the Palestinians out. Thank you very much. I don't take them seriously. Yeah, listen to what I have to say. That's the only way to do it as far as I can see.
So, Jason, what do you think about the idea that America has become so non-white in its younger generations that really there will be no sense coming out of America? And even if you get a result that you might think is a good thing, that might not be a good thing due to the fact that it is mainly non-whites being polled. Where you live, do you see that? Do you see this massive growth in non-whites? And if you do see this, what hope do you actually see for America?
Well, to start at the end there, there's a lot of hope for America. Where there is a white man, there is all the hope in the universe. There is nothing that we cannot achieve. And recapturing our destiny is certainly within the bounds or the limits of that ability. So I would say that. Now, and then again, working backwards, there are far, far more non-white people than in the United States than there used to be, and particularly here in Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C., where it is it's just inundated on a daily basis. We get more non-white people from around the world, and of course, they have much higher birth rates, in part because of their genetic impulse, culture, and the fact that we are forced the white taxpayers are forced to pay for their births. Just as an aside, this crazy idea that these abortion clinics or something, that they're meant to exterminate some particular group or two of non-whites is totally absurd, because we actually pay non-white people to have babies. The more they have, the more money the government will force me and all of the other white taxpayers to give them to have more babies. So that's another absurdity of the anti-white ideology. But I will tell you, I everything Arthur just said was brilliant. I concur with everything he just said. And one of the things that we have predicted in the white positosphere for a long time is that as this population changes in the United States, this was the case that we saw would happen, that more and more of these non-white people, they have no idea what this Holocaust is. They don't care. They don't feel responsible for it, even when they are, even when they're knowledgeable of it. So there is no guilt there whatsoever. There's no such thing as black guilt or brown guilt or yellow guilt. They don't care. And therefore, this very powerful weapon that is wielded over the white population here becomes absolutely ineffective for the group that would like to wield it. And I really concur about the, oh, you know, the other thing I wanted to mention before I just said, because it just came back to mind, Arthur said earlier in the show about what if we woke up one day and, you know, like 98% of the white women were pretending to be non-white women. And I was thinking I would immediately become a monk. That would be just, I would leave the population. I would head right into the monastery. But no, in all seriousness, when this conversation arises, what I like to do about this event in history, taking the same tact that Arthur suggested, depending on, you know, what your objectives are, who you're trying to reach. And I mean, now we can say, in fact, I have been saying for maybe about 10 years, you're talking about an event that's nearly 100 years ago. Nearly 100 years ago, let's let historians deal with that, and we're going to move forward with the recapture of our destiny and our lives in the here and now. But I also like to bring up the fact, I will pigeonhole those who bring this subject up by saying, okay, then, so I'm not allowed to be white, because this is where it's brought up, is in putting your face, is the moment you want to be white positive, the moment you want to recapture our destiny, the moment you want to defend our people from something that is absolutely egregious being done to us, it's then that this argument will be trudged up. Well, if we don't inflict this injury, then this. And I like to then immediately say, so that there isn't a Holocaust of some non-white people, we have to genocide and Holocaust Western kind. And then they're put into a position of having to say, well, and you'll see, you'll gain a lot of traction when you do that, because what essentially you have reduced their argument to what it is, which is the way to prevent this objectionable thing is to eradicate the white race, is to not allow the white race to have any well-being whatsoever. And then, of course, I also like to shift the conversation to the subject of should any period in history be illegal? Should it be illegal to investigate? Should it be illegal to question? Why is it illegal? And of course, then they have a very difficult time defending that subject matter. But I would like to see, I'll just pass it back. I would like to actually see, whenever there's a polls, I worked on the Hill in Washington, D.C., and I've read lots of polls over the years. And it's amazing how they can word them and how they can be asked to get certain responses out of the people they are calling. And we also have to remember that in the United States, if they're asking questions of white people that they're polling, you can have the Bradley effect. And especially this is even more the case now, where the white people, when they're called, even though they think it's anonymous, they still feel like, well, I could be found out. And I know what happens in the United States when it's discovered that you're a heretical to this anti-white narrative. And so they will give the anti-white response. So I would like to, keeping that in mind, I would like to actually see the polls' questions and see the demographics, psychographics of the people that they've reached out to. But my guess is that Arthur is absolutely right here. My hunch is that this is the non-white population in the United States that are being primarily polled, because their numbers are blossoming. And they simply do, even if they find out, they simply will not care about this event in history. And that will not bode well for those individuals who would like to wield that event as a tool of control over those populations. And I pass it back.
Well, yep, Mark, sorry, if I could just throw in the yes. NWG is absolutely correct there, because I know from my own personal experience of opinion polls is that opinion polls are almost always conducted in urban areas, because it's simply easier and quicker because of the population concentration. And I don't have to spell out to anyone in America, certainly, what the population makeup of almost every single major US city is like. So you're immediately going to get a distortion. I think if you, this is one of the reasons why, for example, the opinion polls always get it wrong with Donald Trump. Why they got it wrong in 2016 and why they're probably going to get it wrong in 2020, because they have these opinion polls and they say, oh, we're going to have A, B, C, E, 1, 2, and 3, and we're going to combine two. They send out their opinion pollsters and they ignore race, and they find that in Washington, D.C., 80% of everyone they speak to is going to vote for Joe Biden. They ignore the fact that 79% of everyone they've spoken to is black.
Yes.
And yeah. So on and so on and so forth. Whereas if you go to rural Virginia, or you go to anywhere else, you're going to find 80-90% Trump. And that I think it came out very clearly in the Hillary Clinton book, What Happened, when she issued that, oh, what happened to me book. And she only realized that she'd lost the election, because she believed all the opinion polls. She only realized she'd lost the election when the guy running her numbers in Florida phoned her up. It's a very interesting section in the book. Phoned her up and said to her, your figures in Florida are great, but Donald Trump's are just amazing, out of this world, because they hadn't predicted the white turnout. So these are all the distortions at work. And let me give you another example of a distortion in the opinion polls. You'll often read that 60-something percent or 70% of Americans are obese. That's a very commonly stated fact. But if you look at the actual racial breakdowns, and the CDC do the racial breakdowns, you'll find that, in fact, it's still a high figure, but it's still only about 40% of whites are classified as obese in America, and 67 or 72% of blacks and 62% of Hispanics are classified as obese.
Right.
But they combine all the figures and they say, 70% of Americans are obese. With the result, they're able to project the image of the Walmart shopper as a typical fat, blobby, white American.
Yes.
In actual fact, a minority of Americans are like that. And that goes with everything. That goes with politics. That goes with gun control. It goes with all of these polls. I have actually stopped. I used to subscribe to the Pew Research Center polls because I thought it was great. And I realized they were just talking nonsense.
Yeah,
they were just talking nonsense. And I ignore the polls. The polls, the only thing that counts is hardcore demographics.
But precisely, very quickly, Mark, and I'll toss it right back. Absolutely, 100% right. Thank you, Arthur, for saying, because there have been some people in the white positive sphere that otherwise have some, I don't know why anybody gives them credibility anymore, but they've been trying to rewrite the history of what happened during the last election, saying that the polls were showing that Trump was going to win. Absolutely nowhere near the case. They said the exact opposite. They said Hillary was going to win. And we know, in fact, I did a video I still have up on my channel, I believe. And if it's not there, I'll repost it, where I said the polls were getting it exactly the way they wanted to get it, which was to show that Hillary's going to win so that it would have the psychological effect on the population to get those out to vote for Hillary that they wanted to vote, to prevent people from coming out to vote for Trump. And that's the exact thing they're doing right now. It's like we live in the world of the hamster attention span, and no one can remember just 4 years ago that this was the exact thing they did back then. They said Hillary was going to absolutely crush Donald Trump, and they're saying the same thing about this Biden character right now. Thank you so very much for saying that. And thank you for pointing out as well that in the United States, they combine the white population's stats and the all of the non-white population stats to then give the stats for America. So they talk about the murder rate, they talk about the rape rate, they talk about all of these things as though the white people in America are somehow radically different than the white people in other parts of the world. And in fact, we see that some have teased out the data looking specifically at race, and they find that, I remember this was years ago, a poll that we looked at where the data had been teased out, and the white crime rate in the United States was lower, I believe they said, than the white crime rate in the UK, even though rate in the United States was much higher than the crime rate in the UK.
That is actually true. I go into the racial breakdown of crime in that book, The War Against Whites.
Okay.
Sorry, Mark, I know you leap wanting to say something. I just have to say this very quickly. What the FBI does, the FBI only has, I think, four classifications of race. They have white, black, and then they have Asians, Pacific Islander, Native American. So everyone who isn't a black, a Native American or Asian Pacific Islander gets dumped into the white category. So all the Hispanic gang murders and all of that all gets blamed on whites. Every single Arab crime in America gets blamed on whites. And with the result, when you strip out, and there is a way to do it, and I do it in the book, when you strip it out, the actual white crime rate is almost insignificant. It's so insignificant that if all the non-whites had to be removed from America tomorrow, you could probably close down 90% of all the prisons in America. That's how dramatic it is. And that's not an exaggeration. That's an absolute truth. I just want to say one last thing about America, and then we'll go back to Mark because I know he's dying to say something. Yes, I mentioned the majority of under 20-year-olds in America are non-white, and within the next 8 years, the majority of 30-year-olds are going to be majority non-white, and the year after that, and it speeds up exponentially. However, that does ignore the fact that there are, in fact, just as many, if not more, whites in America than what there were a few years ago. That's where the distortion comes in that the white population is at the moment not shrinking. The white population isn't in America is in fact still growing, but expressed as a total percentage of the population, it is declining. And that, I think, for any white American who seeks a future, that has to be a beacon of hope. Well, what I do think is going to have to happen, and far be it from me to dispense advice to Americans, I'm not an American, but if I were an American, I would be looking at a policy of deliberate geographic consolidation in an area or areas where I could form a demographic majority and hold out. I don't believe it's possible for white American political activists to take on the system. The system is too rigged. The system is too controlled. I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. It would be fantastic if I'm wrong. I'd be happy to admit it. But I do think that there needs to be a determined political effort to geographically consolidate in a state or states or area in which white Americans are the majority, because political power comes from demographic possession. It does not come from anything else. It does not come from historical rights. It does not come from the Constitution. It does not come from a belief system. It comes from demographic possession. And if you want the best example I can give you, look at the Jews. Until the Jews formed a majority in Palestine, Israel did not exist. Now that the Jews form a majority in Palestine, Israel exists. And you can stand on your head and you can say, oh, they took it through violence or whatever. You can stand on your head. You can say whatever you want. But it exists because they demographically majority occupy that territory. And in the old law of might is right, those who occupy a territory will determine that territory's political, social, and economic future. And I think white American political activists have to understand that and take that lesson to heart, because there is still the space in America to do it.
Okay, we're going to do the super chats in a second, but there is one final thing I'll say about the issue of certain historical occurrences, I believe there are three things that form the three pillars of white guilt. We are beaten down with narratives on slavery, colonialism, and the Holocaust. Hmm. And those three things give anti-whites three gigantic sticks with which they beat us. And those three sticks are collectively bound under the term racism. And when people say you're a racist, those three historical occurrences are what they use to justify their narrative. And when I wrote in my book about those three historical occurrences, I believe that children in school are hit with those three things.
Yes.
You're slavers. You took things from other countries and colonized them. And your ancestors pushed all these wonderful movie makers and film critics and
doctors
and, you know, pop music makers into camps and did away with them. Mm-hmm. Thus, because of those three incidents, white people are inherently evil.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that any weakening of that narrative, those official narratives on those subjects, is a bonus to us wherever that weakening occurs. Because for the past, I don't know, since the end of the Second World War, those three narratives have held the people of the West in a kind of mental awe that have prevented them advocating for their own rights. And whilst simply being a historical revisionist group that talked about those three things would not be enough, because we need to ensure that demographics is front and center to every argument, ensuring the demographic survival of our people is very much linked with the mental health of our people.
Mm-hmm.
And when our people hate themselves, when our people feel guilt for things that either didn't happen or happened in a very markedly different way to the way they're portrayed. And this doesn't just amount to the Second World War or the Holocaust. This is also something that affects colonialism and slavery. I did a video on slavery, and it's very interesting to note that at the height of the slave trade, the very height of the slave trade in America, only 1.4% of free Americans owned slaves. And a large proportion of those 1.4% of free Americans that owned slaves were coincidentally the Americans who now attack whites for owning slaves. And, but we're going to have to go on to the super chats, because otherwise we're not going to get through. We've got quite a few. And my point is that I believe that to get people to think about being white positive, one of the first things you have to get them to shed is their guilt. Because as long as they're shackled with that guilt, they will never, ever advocate for their own interests. That's just my opinion. But we are going to have to go to the super chats. Junta Mominari gave $20 and said, are you aware the US census has all races below replacement fertility? In fact, if it wasn't for recent African migrants, blacks would be below whites. In 2030, the majority of population growth will be from immigration. The same year, all countries outside of Africa and Israel will be replacement or below. Has anyone got a quick take on that?
That's definitely true. The only answer to that is the attainment or seizure of political power in a country or country, European country or country, or in America in a territory where a policy or an environment conducive to white reproduction, large-scale reproduction, is possible. Otherwise, yes, it's a very serious issue, and those who don't reproduce are destined for the grave.
Thank you. Heidi Kunish Van Buskirk gave $20. Thank you very much, and simply said, big shout out to you all. Well, thank you very much. Junta Mominari gave another $10. Thank you very much. And he said, in 2100, Africans will be 50% of the world population, but will finally fall below replacement. Can you name the only country that will have an above replacement fertility? Israel. I checked multiple sources to be sure. Population Research Institute, US Census, World Bank, Population Reference Bureau, etc. Well, I'll just give a very quick take on that. I think with the way the world's changing at the moment, and I think with the radical changes we're seeing, I think it's very hard to predict exactly what's going to be happening in around 80 years. One thing we know for sure is that if things carry on, we will be minorities in our own countries. Mm. However, saying all that, I believe that Europeans have been close to the brink before. And I believe many great civilizations have risen and fallen. But the reason we have folk tales like the Phoenix is because wise men know that strong men build strong civilizations, but strong civilizations create weak men, and weak men cannot defend those civilizations. And in the fire that consumes those civilizations, strong men are again born, and so the cycle continues. And I sometimes wonder whether we're destined to repeat that, and whether we are just playing our part in that endless cycle, and we are the people preparing other whites for the inevitable fire where we will see our rebirth. But whatever our role is, building this community is vital to our survival. What do you think, Arthur, on those facts?
I think you're absolutely, I think that's a very good philosophical approach to take. I am not really a philosophical person, but what I will say is, from a practical point of view, if one looks at the size of founding populations. And here is a fact that I often quite like to quote. The NASA had a project a little while ago called Project Hyperion, and they worked out, they asked geneticists to work out how many people they would have to, how many humans they'd have to ship to another planet to found a genetically stable colony, i.e. allowing for natural deaths, preventing inbred genetic problems, all that type of stuff. And the conclusion of the geneticists was 40,000 people, which, when you think about it, is a tiny number. And then when you look back at the ancient European founding populations, you realize the numbers were all fairly similar. That's why European peoples tend to look the same, because they all have a common founding population. So yes, I believe quite sincerely, I don't think it's going to happen, but I believe we could lose 80 or 90% of our current European population and still survive. So no, I'm convinced that there will be a reckoning and there will be a comeback. Not sure how it's going to happen, but we've been through crises before, and we are going to survive this one. There's just no doubt about it. There's just too many of us.
Jason, do you think we'll survive the crisis, or are you ending it all now?
I totally agree with the both of you. I mean, there's nothing the men of the West can't do when they put their mind to it. And Arthur's absolutely, I remember reading about that now, absolutely right, from a genetic point of view. But we have the stories of our great heroes taking on, I mean, when it comes to the battlefield, these stories of one warrior taking on 10, 12, 15, 20 others from other tribes around the globe and being victorious, glorious tales, sagas, and everything from that to our greatest doctors, our healers, our adventurers. We have done so much. There's nothing we can't do. And here's the very exciting thing. The blood of every single one of those men and women are in your veins. You need only to tap into it, and we can be the people of legends. So I'll pass that back, Mark.
Thank you. We've got a super chat here from Serena JB for £5. Thank you very much, Serena. And she says, how do people who have been in the nationalist movement for so long keep their spirits in such grim times? I know that all of you on the panel have been in this for a long time. My thanks go out to all you do. Well, thank you so much, Serena, for the super chat. And I'll answer this very briefly. I stay in high spirits because I know I'm doing the right thing, and I have faith that we're going to win. I know that what we're doing isn't going to be easy, but anything worth having is never easy to get. There's always some kind of struggle involved when you're trying to do something that involves achieving greatness. And I have always believed that we are going to win. And the other thing, the other reason I'm in high spirits is because ultimately, at the moment, I have never, ever seen so many people willing to talk about race, talk about demographics, and also throw off the shackles of the guilt I talked about earlier. You know, when we were in the BNP, I think, and I don't know whether Arthur disagrees with me here, but we used to have an event every year called the Red, White and Blue. And the biggest ever Red, White and Blue, there was over 3,000 people. And the biggest ever numbers we've got on this show has been over 3,000 people watching. Tonight we've had nearly 2,000 at our peak. But at sort of an average year's Red, White and Blue, there'd be about 2,000 people there, just over 2,000 people. Would you agree with that, Arthur?
Yep, that's fair enough.
Now, if you said to the 2,000 people at the Red, White and Blue, who are the hardcore BNP supporters, if you said to them all and polled them, do you reject the term racist? Do you throw off white guilt created by colonialism, the slavery and the Holocaust? And do you absolutely stand for white people and to prevent the demographic replacement of the indigenous people of these islands? I'm not as confident that those 2,000 people at the Red, White and Blue, our biggest event, would have unanimously said yes to that. In fact, I think some people would have been scared about those topics. And I know in the BNP, there were people who were very reticent and hesitant to even talk about our people as indigenous people, or to use the term white, or to advocate for us as a racial or ethnic group. And one thing that gives me such overwhelming happiness and positivity is seeing the massive numbers we bring in on this show every week of people who want to talk about those issues and people who aren't scared to say, yep, I'm white, I'm proud of it, I reject the guilt, and I want to advocate for my people. And seeing the growth of people who want to discuss race as an issue in the way that Arthur discussed it tonight. Because I think you'd agree, Arthur, if you'd have said some of the things you said tonight, especially at the beginning of the show about race, IQ, that would have caused some people to curl their toes up in the BNP. But I think now far more people are open to those kind of discussions. How do you guys feel about this?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think a lot has happened. I think probably it's one of the ironies that the increasingly overt anti-white nature of the establishment's assault has forced a lot of people to say, wait a minute, what's going on? I had someone write to me the other week saying, well, you know, previously I would have never read anything like this, but in the light of what's going on, I'll give it a try. And I think that is happening far more commonly than what people give credit for. And I think you're right. I think as the establishment becomes more and more extreme, a lot more white people are going to say, well, bugger it, do we really need to stand up for this?
Do you have a quick take on this, Jason, sure, or should we move on?
Just the same thing really quickly to say that it's the fact that they're drunk with their power, the anti-whites, and as a consequence, they're dropping those, what we refer to as the myths of pretext, the moralization, intellectualization, and sentimentalization of pretext to arrive at that anti-white conclusion of being able to victimize us. As they drop those pretexts increasingly because they are in absolute control, the white population then sees the naked aggression for what it is, and they're more likely to look elsewhere for leadership. Let's roll, brother.
Okay, Miss Britannia gave $5. Thank you very much. And she said, this one's for you, Arthur. It's a statement, but I think you'll like it. Arthur, my father was a huge fan. Many of my cousins were ejected from their farms in Rhodesia. Thank you for your hard work. Yeah. Martin Smith gave $3. Thank you very much. And he said, I'm a very reluctant ethno-nationalist. We've been forced into a corner. Well, a quick message, Martin. Thank you for the super chat. But never be reluctant to love your own people and advocate for their well-being. There is no shame in being white. JP gave $10. Thank you very much. And he said, love the show. Keep doing God's work. Well, thank you very much. The Thin Red Line gave $5. You don't have to answer this, Arthur, but he said, will Arthur join Patriotic Alternative?
Well, never say never, but I'm a firm believer that there are people who don't know when it's time to hand over to younger people and fresher faces. And I'm more than happy to let other people take the forefront.
Well, I will say this. I'm not going to force you to join, Arthur, but I am going to try and twist your arm into coming and speaking at one of our meetings, because I think you would be an excellent guest speaker at one of our biannual conferences. That would be absolutely amazing. I know it'll take a lot of arm twisting, but I think tonight you've introduced a whole new generation to your oratory skills, and I can see from the audience they already want more. Storks gave $10. Thank you very much. And he said, are you optimistic about the future of nationalism in the UK? Well, yes, I am. I think we've kind of answered that before, but does anyone else have any other takes on that?
Nope. No, I think, Mark, you're doing great work. I realise you're doing great work when a couple of weeks ago, I didn't realise what it was about at the time, but I realised it later. I got these pathetically overt phishing emails from Hope Not Hate fronts asking me about you and asking me about saying, well, they want to get in. And it was overtly what it was all about. And I just dismissed it, of course, because they must think I was born yesterday. And then, of course, they produced the report on you and Patriotic Alliance, the hit piece, the little scribble journalism. And I thought, aha, Mark must be doing something good if they're fishing around.
Well, thank you, Arthur. I am doing my best to do something good. And hopefully, if it wasn't for this stupid coronavirus lockdown, I would have done a hell of a lot more this year. Damien Demento gave £10. Thank you very much, Damien. He said, evening all. Question for Arthur. What can the English learn from white South Africans in preparation for us becoming a minority in England?
Well, the first thing you have to do, you have to fight to the last man to stop becoming a minority. That's the very first thing you must do. It's not over until the fat lady sings. However, if you are forced into it, I think you can learn from the principle of geographic consolidation and the town of Orania, which is based not by breaking any law and not by being radical, but just by observing its own culture and its own community and welcoming within its own community its own people, and build a basis from which further political activity may be possible. So if you want a long-term suggestion, start looking at geographic consolidation as well. But your primary goal must be fighting on the political front.
Well, I can say this. We are working on geographical consolidation. Everyone is invited to come and live near me. We barbecue every Sunday at 4 p.m. and everyone knows the quality of my barbecue. And I just want to thank Arthur, because there are people out there who say, I'm not saying the political route is the be-all and end-all, but those who say that the political route is completely closed to us are absolute doom merchants. The fact is, whilst we are still a majority, and if we consolidate our numbers, there is no reason why we cannot achieve some form of representation which would be greatly beneficial to those in the area where that representation was held. So thank you for that, Arthur. And it's good to hear such a wise old hand talk about things like that. Tim gave $10 and said, do you think it's possible that both Trump and Biden will refuse to concede defeat in the election in November? Now, that's an interesting question. I think the simple answer is yes, but really this is one for Jason. Do you think that will be the case?
I think, well, the anti-whites that who call themselves Democrats, they have already spoken about being taking a stand that no matter what the outcome is, do not concede defeat. Hillary Clinton specifically spoke to this. And we have them saying a lot of things that I think they shouldn't have revealed if they were playing their hands right, but they're not exactly the smartest people anymore. So I think that we're going to see, of course, Trump is not going to be conceding defeat because he's not going to lose unless there is some sort of significant illegal election activity, some chicanery behind the scenes. But the anti-whites who call themselves Democrats, they are absolutely not going to be conceding. At some degree, I mean, I don't know exactly what Biden will end up saying, but the idea here is that they want to draw out this question of whether or not Trump is a legitimate president for perhaps the totality of his term, and to geld him, to prevent him from taking any sorts of actions and accomplishing the objectives and promises that he made to the population. And this in connection with what I said last week, and I'll pass it right back, and that is that I had shared my speculation last week here, which I can't share on YouTube, which is that China was, prior to Trump being elected, China was poised to take domination of the world economically, militarily, in several other ways. And Trump came to office. He renegotiated a number of deals, moved some more naval equipment and the like out to contend with China, and they saw their prize, the acme of world domination, disappearing right before their eyes, evaporating right before their eyes. And in a case like that, out in the real world, the jungle, which is where these nations actually wage their conflicts, there is no morality. There is no ethics. It is whatever it takes to win. And so I shared that potentially the Chinese built and released the coronavirus on purpose, releasing it in their population so that they would have plausible deniability to the masses of the world, not to the leaders of the world, who would be able to figure it out quite readily. And that was last Wednesday. And then just yesterday on Tucker, he had on a Chinese scientist from Hong Kong, and she's ostensibly one of their highest ranked scientists, and she now is in hiding. And she shared that according to the research that she was able to do and her colleagues, that this is absolutely a man-made virus. And she likened it to coming across a cow with rabbit ears and monkey hands, and said that the Chinese government released it on purpose, and that she would be releasing more information in the coming weeks. So I think that if you look at the Chinese and you look at a long-term view of how they could retake that track that they were on to world domination, undermining Trump, anticipating exactly how the Democrats would use the virus to their benefit here in the United States to undermine and geld Trump, circumventing everything he wanted to do, it works out perfectly. It's just a theory. It doesn't mean that it's the case, of course. But to answer the question in short, yes, the Democrats are not going to concede defeat. They're going to continue to challenge the legitimacy of President Donald Trump for the next 4 years.
Thank you very much. Alex May gave £20. Thank you, Alex. And he said, Mark, now we have the social distancing rule of a maximum of 6 people. Shall we organise our social events around grouse shooting, as that is still allowed for more than 6? Do you think that will generate alarming headlines along the lines of armed fire right group go hunting? Well, I think it's amazing, isn't it? You know, one of the few things that's been exempted from this rule of 6 is the Conservative Party upper echelon's favourite activity of grouse shooting. That is a fantastic super chat. Thank you, Alex. And yes, we will be holding our conference now in a couple of weeks out on the moors with shotguns, taking down the grouse during the speeches. Jez gave £10. Thank you very much, Jez. And he said, Arthur, do you think South Africa would be better off today if, instead of enacting apartheid, the government had expelled all non-whites, even if it had to cede some of South Africa to do so?
There's no doubt about it. I've written one of the books I wrote on this was called The Lie of Apartheid, which dealt specifically with this issue, that apartheid was predicated upon the exploitation of black labor rather than creating an Afrikaner state. So what they did is they used non-white labor to build everything, and then they expected the blacks to be happy with exercising political and social rights in their homelands, their traditional homelands, which were their traditional homelands. But of course, it doesn't work like that because, as I said earlier, political power comes from demographic possession. There was never a territory inside the old South Africa in which whites were the majority. And therefore, it was a historical inevitability, as the Marxists say. There was a historical inevitability that political power would be transferred. The only way that could have been avoided would have been for whites to geographically consolidate in a territory inside South Africa and to declare it an Afrikaner state. Ironically, the biggest opponents of that policy would have been the right wing, who objected to any idea that any part of the country could be given up. So, yes, that's what they should have done. Their refusal to accept the link between demographics and political power and the utter failure of apartheid because of its reliance upon black labor and its ultimately immoral policy of social segregation over its reliance on black labor, it was guaranteed to fall. Yes, they should have separated and taken a smaller area, and that should have been done back in the 50s and 60s.
Arthur, we've really got to fly through these last super chats, but I always use this quote, and I think it's actually your quote. I always say it's not my own words, but I think it was you that said the problem with white South Africans is they'd rather be murdered in their bed by their black servants than have to face the prospect of making their bed themselves in the morning.
Yeah, that's slightly elongated. What my exact words in the live apartheid was, the definition of a white South African is someone who'd rather be murdered in their bed than make it. That's the exact quote, and that's exactly what it was. Yes.
Well, there you heard it. I've said it before. People have heard me say it. That is an Arthur Kemp quote. Squirrels gave $5 Canadian and said, "Hopefully, this is a white pill. One of my best friends just gave birth to a beautiful baby girl, and I learned a few days ago that I am pregnant. Make babies, everyone." Well, that is a white pill.
Right.
Congratulations to your friend, and also congratulations to you. That is absolutely fantastic, and that is the news that we like to hear on this show. Phil Barker gave $5 and said, "Great guest tonight. Does Arthur think liberalism is the source of Western decline? It seems to be the source of gender neutrality, anti-racism, materialism, and mass immigration. Arthur, is liberalism the cause of our decline?"
Liberalism is a symptom. I don't think it's the primary cause. The primary causes are far deeper psychological issues. The issues which you mentioned, the three cudgel issues which you mentioned earlier, the whole post-1945 political dynamic. There's a number of factors which have all led into this. Liberalism has its origin in humanism, and humanism goes back to that's another topic all to itself. But I don't think you can name one specific thing, but certainly it's a major symptom.
Thank you very much. The Thin Red Line gave $5 and said, "Great stream, guys. We will win." Thank you very much. Bryneth Maldon, I was really looking forward to this one, Arthur, because this is one for you, as you are the historical mastermind. He gave £25. Thank you very much. And he said, "Who built Great Zimbabwe as the only sub-Saharan city? This has puzzled me for some time." Who built it, Arthur?
That's an easy one to answer, believe it or not. A very learned Scotsman by the name of Robert Gere of Gere. He actually founded the journal Mankind Quarterly, which you might or might not have heard of. It's currently being run by Richard Lynn, Mankind Quarterly. But Richard Gere of Gere went out to Rhodesia as it was then, specifically with the objective of finding out, doing archaeological and whatever research he could on the ruins of Greater Zimbabwe. Now, when you talk about the ruins of Zimbabwe, we're talking about the actual falling down building. We're not talking about the present day country. The old joke. Sorry, that's a very old joke. Anyway, Robert Geer of Geer wrote a book called The Origins of the Zimbabwean Civilization, which is a fantastic book published in Salisbury in Rhodesia in 1970. And I've actually got it here and I'm going to reproduce it. It's a fantastic book. Anyway, what he did through archaeological excavations, through historical geographical comparisons, and through excavations on the site, he proved without any shadow of a doubt that this was originally part of a Middle Eastern, possibly Phoenician, possibly Arabic slave trading station. And he showed that by doing building comparisons and buildings in the Middle East with the actual style and structure of Great Zimbabwe, and also the artifacts which he dug out. He dug out, for example, Middle Eastern glasswork. We found beads, glasswork, other artifacts which clearly came from as far away as the Middle East, which just goes to show that what it was probably part of some Arabic semi-Caucasian penetration into southern Africa, because as you might not know, the Arab slave traders were active in the Congo until the 1890s. I don't know, most people don't know that. There's a very good book about it called The Congo-Arab War, written by one of the British officers who were involved in the war against the Congo Arabs. But it's very likely that the Great Zimbabwe was built by Middle Easterner explorers into southern Africa, and when they left, the black tribes then took it over and occupied it and changed a little few rocks here and there, with the result they claim it as theirs now. But there's no doubt that archaeologically and architecturally is the word I'm looking for, it comes from the Middle East.
Well, thank you very much, Arthur. I'm really pleased you answered that, because somebody once threw that up at me and I offered sort of a similar answer to that based on guesswork, because there is another African, people claim it was an early African civilization, but it's exactly the same as Great Zimbabwe. I can't remember the name of it, but it is not indeed Wakanda. They were both Arab slave trading stations, but you have provided the facts to back that up, which I could not. So thank you very much. Shooter McGavin gave $3. Thank you very much. And he said, hi, Mark. Great show again. Quick question for Jason. Is Jason aware that he's got a growing Telegram fan club in a certain chat? He's even got his own sticker collection. Cheers, Mark. Well, Jason, you know about this, so we're not commenting on this tonight, but I will send you the link.
Okay.
Daniel Lewis gave £20. Thank you very much. And he just simply said 14. Thank you. Simon Coates gave £5. Thank you very much, Simon. He said, can Arthur come back on the show soon, please? Will you appear again, Arthur?
Yes, okay.
Well, that is the answer to that. Now, we do have some unpaid questions that we can go through quickly. Rory Herbert said, Arthur, I have a friend whose cousins were murdered on their farm in South Africa. What is your opinion on the genocide that's happening there?
Oh, you want me to get really unpopular now, Mark. In 1990, I was invited to address the annual general meeting of the Transvaal Agricultural Union. And I gave an address to the Transvaal Agricultural Union, AGM, in which I told them that their reliance on black labor was going to be their undoing, and that they should immediately mechanize, and they should get rid of their black laborers before it becomes legally impossible to do so. The speech went down like a pig at a bar mitzvah, and it was possibly the most unsuccessful speech I've ever given. And I'm afraid the white farmers in South Africa, it's a tragic situation, and it breaks my heart to see it happening. But, you know, every white farmer in South Africa has got hundreds of black laborers on their farm, and their wives, and their children. So every white farmer on his farm is probably outnumbered 500 or 1,000 to 1 on their farms, never mind the surrounding areas, never mind all the ancillary economics that they're driving. So white farmers in South Africa, as tragic as the situation is, it's a product of the non-understanding of the relationship between political power and demographics. And my advice to white South African farmers is right now to geographically consolidate, move to a territory, possibly the Northern Cape or somewhere like that, where you can start again. The land claims have all been sorted out in the Northern Cape, where you can start again, where you can start a new farm and recognize. As long as you rely on hundreds and hundreds of black laborers, you are going to be in peril. And that's a horrible, sad truth. And it breaks my heart to see all the reports of farm murders and that, but it's the inevitable consequence. It would be like if I had to tell No White Guilt. If No White Guilt went and started a KFC in the city center of Detroit, and then after 6 months, say, Arthur, I keep on getting robbed. I keep on getting mugged. They're going to kill me next. I would say, what did you expect? And I'm afraid it's the same with the farmers. The farmers need to address the situation on the ground. And only when they address the situation on the ground will the situation be alleviated.
Thank you. We have a question here from the white butterfly, the lovely Jody, and she says, Entropy won't process my payment. Thank you, Arthur, for your uplifting inspiration. I've just ordered your book and cannot wait to deepen my knowledge, understanding, and rhetoric. Thank you. Well, Jody's a great new content creator, so you have won a lot of hearts and minds tonight, Arthur. It's been a great show. And we've got another statement here. This is from 300 Spartans. I know who this guy is, and I'll tell you after the show. Great to see Arthur on PWR. My copy of March of the Titans is well thumbed these days. What does the panel think of the filthy SNP's Scottish hate crime and public order bill? Well, it's absolutely scandalous. I think that one of the biggest problems in Scotland is there is a party that calls itself a national party that bases its entire existence on hatred of the English, whilst at the same time taking huge amounts of money from the Barnett formula, English money, to fund its anti-English hatred. Incredible. But what they also use that money for is to pass laws which will ultimately see Scotland turn into the most multicultural, anti-white part of the United Kingdom. And this is incredible because I believe that the Scots, despite being told to hate the English, are now being told quite openly that anyone that lives in Scotland and says they're Scottish is by default a Scotsman. So what you'll end up with is a country that does absolutely hate the English, but sadly, it won't have any Scots left in it. And that is the tragedy of the SNP. Do you have any takes on that, Arthur?
Oh, it's just like Plaid Cymru in Wales. And it's just like Sinn Féin in Ireland and Northern Ireland. Many, many years ago, I had the chance to visit the Sinn Féin offices in Belfast just to pick up some mementos and some books and literature and stuff like that. And I actually asked them about would I be able to live in the Catholic area of Belfast just as an experiment. And the Sinn Féin person said, "Hi, are you Catholic?" And I said, yes, I'm Catholic. And she said, "Oh, yes, they're sure, no problem at all." And you can see it reflected in the immigration policies to this day, where you actually now have Nigerian Catholic black Sinn Féin candidates standing for parliament. So hate the English, yes, what they've oppressed us, blah, 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 but oh no, let's fill the country with Nigerians and Indians and Pakistanis. I'm sure they won't hate us.
Thank you. And we have one last super chat from the Red Squirrels. Thank you very much. £5. Thank you. And they said, great show and great guest, Mark. It has been a great show, and Arthur is a fantastic guest. Thank you very much for the super chat. If you want to make a super chat, there is still time. I've just popped the link in the chat. But we have reached the end of the super chats. And before we do the final roundup, I just want to play something very quickly. I promised I would do this. So I'm just going to tee it up. I just want to remind everyone that we're giving a plug to the White Art Collective, who are live on DLive on here after we finish our show. But I did promise I would play their trailer for their film festival. So I'm just going to do that now before we do our roundup.
Do you like to make spooky movies? And get ready for the WAC second annual Spooky Short Film Contest and Festival. With three cash prizes. With so many spooky shorts.
We need to talk about my son. I need to know where he is. Do you know where he is?
He's with the fairies.
Don't be chicken. Join us.
So that's the White Art Collective. They have an annual film festival, and they do that on the 23rd of October. I said I'd give their little trailer a plug, and they are live after the show. So if you want more nationalist content straight away, please go and support them. They are on DLive. And that about brings us to the end of our show, and it's time to do the final roundups and goodbyes. Well, first and foremost, I've got to say a huge, huge thank you to my old friend Arthur. It has been amazing working with you again. Obviously, I've seen you since the collapse of the BNP, and we speak very, very regularly. But thank you for coming on. It's taken me a long time to persuade you, but this has been one of the best shows we've done. And I've been looking forward to this for a long time, because having ex-BNP members on is always something fantastic. And I really hope we can get you back again in the future. If you can please plug your work one last time before we close and give us any final thoughts that you have.
Sure. Mark, thank you very much for having me on. It's been great. I really appreciate your work as well. I think what you're doing with the Patriotic Alliance and everywhere else is really fantastic. I think that the only thing I can say in summary would be that we are not going anywhere. We are going to carry on. Death will be the enemy's release from our efforts. And we will never stop until we win. And that's it. So, yeah, anyone who wants to buy a book is welcome to do so at astarapublications.com. You can read my irregularly updated blog, arthurkemp.com. And that's about it.
Well, thank you very much, Arthur. It's been fantastic having you here, and hopefully we can have you on again soon. Jason, my friend, where can we find you, and who is on the after party?
KnowWhyGuilt.org, theafterparty.tv, Friday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to have Eke Lux on the after party. It's going to be a fantastic conversation about everything going on in the United States and around the world, the attacks on Western civilization, and these hit squads, these anti-white hit squads, taking down everything that we love and hold dear. Big debt of gratitude to Arthur Kemp and all the great work that he has done for white well-being. We thank you dearly, sir, for those efforts over the years. And it's been a great honor to be able to sit with you here in conversation and share thoughts with you and hear your in-depth, insightful account and understanding of everything that's going on in the world. I think we all benefited from that, and we should all, if everybody wants to get out a round of applause of the emojis in the chat for Arthur. That would be fantastic. And now I'm going to pass it back to Mark, and I'm just going to let everybody know that as soon as I get off the air here, I'm going to get on the phone with my accountant, my lawyer, and my business operations manager, and I'm going to be closing that KFC. I'm not going back to the city anymore into that business.
Thank you, Jason. Well, I've just had some news as we were closing the show that my debate with the Black Lives Matter advocates, that is going to be put back a week because they want more time to promote it. So I will be announcing where that will be held. I believe we will most likely hold it on one of Jason's channels or across multiple of Jason's channels so that he can moderate. I don't want to have to moderate my own chat because it looks rather unfair. And I think it's much, much better if I just appear as a guest, because if I'm trying to do all the super chats and manage everything as well as debating with somebody, that might be a task even too great for me. So I think that's well, I did handle four tribe members at one point, but I think doing the super chats at the same time might have pushed me over the edge. But that is going to be good, and I will be promoting that in due course. But sadly, it won't be this Friday when I initially thought it would be. Well, that just leaves me to say thank you, Arthur. Thank you, Jason. Thank you to everybody who donated so generously through the course of this stream. And thank you most of all, as always, to the incredible community who have supported this show tonight. With 2,000 people watching at its height, I think that was an incredible number. I would, of course, have liked more. And, of course, Arthur certainly deserved more, because I think this has been one of the best episodes of PWR and very different to recent ones. So if you like the show, the replay will be on BitChute. So make sure you share that replay and let everyone see Arthur's incredible work. And of course, when it goes up on BitChute, so will links to marchofthetitans.com and to Astara Publishing. Thank you so much. And I will see you all again same time next week for another episode of PWR. Stay safe.